This is URN Sport.
See the match.
Which one?
Don't know.
Hello and welcome to another URN Sport Premier League review. We've left this one a little bit later, so we've got a lot more games to get through. I'm calling this Premier League round 3/4 as we go from the games. We're going from Burnley's 1-0 win against Palace on the 29th of June to Man United's 3-0 win over Aston Villa on the 9th of June. So over that period, that's the games we're going to be talking about. I'm delighted to say we're joined by Benji, Jez and Callum to talk us through this. Supporters who've had kind of mixed fortunes with their respective clubs over the course of this this project restart. But there's only one place to start, really, when we do one of these Premier League reviews, and that is with yet another fantastic quiz.
He's thrown a kettle over a pub. What have you done?
Let's get into it then straight away, gentlemen. I'm going to turn to you, Jez, first for question number one. So like I say, this period of games we're talking about goes from the 29th of June to the 9th of July. So some teams have played twice, other teams have played three times. So this quiz should be extremely difficult. Question number one is, how many teams in this period have scored three or more goals? Now, one exception I want to say is there is one side that have scored three or more goals in the three games that they've played, but only count them once. Don't count them on three separate occasions, if that makes sense.
Right. So, for example, I'm guessing that one team is Man City.
It's the other team from Manchester, actually.
It's Man United, isn't it? I knew it was going to be one of those two. So, one of those, City United, three or more in...
Yeah, three or more in this, the games. Yeah.
Okay. City United, Liverpool all have. I don't think Arsenal have. I'm just looking at Ben for a reaction. I think you've got two in a few games. I don't think you've got three. I don't think it's probably going to be. I think I'll go with seven. It's a bit of a punt, but yeah.
Seven. Callum, would you agree with that, or would you say it's a bit higher?
I feel like it's lower.
Benji?
Five.
You're going with five. Well, Jez, you were the closest with seven, because it is a relatively high number, but you were incorrect to say that Arsenal have not scored three or more goals. They have scored four goals, and that was against Norwich. So the actual answer is 19.
Oh, I've forgotten they're playing Norwich.
So we've got Man United, who scored three or more against Bournemouth, Brighton and Villa. Arsenal, who scored four against Norwich. Newcastle, who scored four away at Bournemouth. West Ham, who scored three against Chelsea. Sheffield United, who scored three against Tottenham. City, who scored four against Liverpool. What a night that was. Five against Newcastle. Leicester, who scored three against Palace. Chelsea, who scored three against Watford and Palace. And Liverpool, who scored three against Brighton. So it's been kind of a free scoring period for some teams. Callum, I'm going to turn to you for this next one. Because it involves one of your favourite clubs and favourite managers, and that's Eddie Howe and Bournemouth. who has scored more goals in this period? Watford, Villa or Bournemouth?
I think Villa have had a couple of not so terrible games, but I still feel like it has to be Watford, because I think they've won the most out of those.
You're going for Watford. Benji, yeah. Benji, what do you think about that one?
I'd have gone for Watford, but watching Villa's games, they've either like scored zero or one. Bournemouth did get two against United, but I mean, a 0-0 draw against Spurs. I'd probably have to say Watford.
Jez, what are you saying, mate?
I'm in agreement with the lads. I think it's Watford. I actually can't really think of Villa scoring more than maybe two goals that whole time, though. I think it's why I saw Jack Grealish has fallen out of everyone's fantasy football teams.
Well, unfortunately, gentlemen, you are all wrong. The answer is Bournemouth, who've scored three goals. They scored one against Newcastle and then two away at Manchester United. Watford have only scored two, and that was in their 2-1 victory over Norwich on Tuesday night. And Villa have scored a great total of zero goals in this last phase of games as well. Benji, let's turn to you now. over the course of this period of games, how many teams have recorded back-to-back wins?
Okay, Arsenal, we've done that. Chelsea have done it. City tend to win one and lose one. Okay, I think City have done it. Liverpool have done it. Spurs have definitely not done it. I'm going to say 7.
You're going for 7. Callum, what's your thoughts on that one?
I have no clue.
No clue. Jez?
I think Ben's right, and I don't think City have. United, obviously. I just try to think, have in this specific period that we're basing the quiz on, if this is where Wolves have started to slow down. I'll go 6. I'll go 6.
Again, unfortunately, gentlemen, you're all wrong.
We're good at this.
There are only 4 teams who've recorded back-to-back victories in this period. That is Arsenal, as Benji alluded to, wins over Norwich and Wolves, Man United. Liverpool, with back-to-back wins over Villa and Brighton, and Chelsea with back-to-back wins over Watford and Crystal Palace. And you're right to say Manchester City haven't done it, because after they beat Liverpool 4-0, I'll bring that up again, they lost to Southampton at St Mary's. So they are unable to record back-to-back victories. Question number 4, we'll go back to you, Jez, for this one. Where, in accordance to the current Premier League table, where is there a bigger points gap? Is it between 5th and 4th, or between 18th and 17th?
Fifth and fourth. So who's fifth at the moment? So fifth and fourth. That's United to Chelsea. Or no, is it to Leicester at the moment? Currently, it's United to Leicester, isn't it?
I'm not helping you out with this, right, I'm afraid.
I think I know it's between like those two, and that's pretty close. And where was the other one? Was it 17th to 18th?
17th to 18th, yeah.
I'll go with 17th to 18th, because I think that the third, fourth, fifth bit is actually very close, because Leicester have sort of been pants.
Callum, what do you think? Where's it closer?
18th, 17th, because I know that one's opened up, so I think it's 7 points now, or it might be tighter. But that one's definitely bigger, because fifth, fourth is where it could change if you get a draw or something like that. So yeah, it's 18th, 17th.
Benji, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I'm going to agree with the lads. It's 18th to 17th, because I remember watching Bournemouth Spurs, and they were showing the points if Bournemouth would have won, and Bournemouth would have been 1 point behind if it was 17th, but it didn't happen. They drew, and yeah, so yeah.
Okay, so currently the gap between Manchester United in 5th place and Leicester in 4th is just 1 point. Leicester on 59, Man United on 58. But the difference between Bournemouth in 18th and Watford in 17th is 3 points. Watford on 31 points, Bournemouth on 28. So 18th to 17th, there is a bigger points gap. And finally, this question is about this week of games. So from this Monday through to Thursday. Benji, how many clean sheets have been recorded in this week of matches? So from Monday to Thursday.
Okay. We didn't keep one. City did. Liverpool did. No, they didn't. Tottenham, Bournemouth both did. Sheffield United did against Wolves. Everton, Southampton didn't. God, I'm gonna stop taking up your time. I'm gonna say 5 teams.
5 teams. Jez, how many you saying there?
Well, I know Burnley's definitely one, because I put Nick Pope on my bench this week and put McCarthy in off the bench. And every week I've done that, the other goalkeeper's kept a clean sheet. So this is going really badly for me in FPL. I don't think it's that many. I'm going to go 6 again.
Callum?
Let's go with 5.
You're going to go with 5. Okay. Well, the answer is actually 7. It's 7 clean sheets have been taken. So we've got Tottenham's clean sheet against Everton on Monday night. Manchester City's clean sheet against Newcastle. Sheffield United's clean sheet against Wolves. Man United's clean sheet against Villa. Burnley's clean sheet against West Ham. And as Benji rightly alluded to, Bournemouth and Tottenham both kept a clean sheet the other night. So it comes
but Tottenham
to
played on Monday as well.
Seven. Yeah. So I think we're getting there with these quizzes. I think we are slowly but surely improving. So yeah, let's see what next week brings into that regard. I suppose the first question I wanted to ask, I'll turn to you, Benji, for this one firstly. You know, you've had a team that have kind of been involved in a couple of these games. We've seen quite a lot of, you know, free scoring, high scoring games in recent days. You know, like I say, Arsenal involved in a 4-0 win over Norwich. Manchester City going back to their usual kind of ways, putting 4 and 5 past the team respectively. Are players now, do you think, starting to get back into the rhythm of football? Are we starting to see the quality that we were seeing before the lockdown was imposed, do you think?
I definitely think so in some cases, particularly Man United, who seem to be scoring more goals than they've ever done before. This wasn't typical of Man United sides. And before lockdown, they improved their form and they've continued it. Arsenal, more confident, it seems, and look more likely to score. But there are some teams that have still remained slow. And I obviously, you know who I'm going to turn to. It's Tottenham. Because, like, having watched their games against Everton and Bournemouth, it looks slow, a bit pathetic at times. But, yeah, obviously there was a three-month break, which is, like, the usual break for the end of the season to the start of the next season. So it was always going to look like in the first few games that teams were going to take a long time to, you know, build up fitness and, you know, but I do feel more and more teams are starting to perform better and there's better for games to watch now.
I think Benji makes a really good point there, Jez, in the sense that the comparison between Man United and Tottenham. In Man United, you've got this free-flowing, attacking, kind of exciting team in the minute, and Tottenham is quite a stale, sluggish side. And it seems that you could almost split the Premier League in half between teams who kind of have come back with an energy and a vigour about their game and teams that are still yet to really get to the races. Over this kind of period of games, which other teams do you think have impressed you and which ones have got room to improve?
I'm assuming you want to talk about Man United in more detail later, so I'll leave that because I think that's one we can break down. Southampton certainly have impressed me since they've come back. I know Callum was saying to me when after the Man City results, you know, I was saying on our group chat that was a very impressive display for them. And Callum, you were saying to me that, you know, actually it is something which is more akin to what people probably have been thinking. So the problem is for Southampton, unfortunately, as good as they might have a run in for the season, that 9-0 is going to hang over them for most of the season, almost as a point of reference for where things might have changed for them and got better. So they've certainly been a team that I've been very impressed by. Initially Wolves, but Wolves have sort of fallen off the boil a bit the last few games, in particular Raul Jimenez. Ever since he broke that record for being Wolves' top goal scorer for a season, he suddenly can't hit a barn door with a banjo. Aside from that, in terms of teams that have absolutely... I think probably the real Marmite team, I think, has been Newcastle, because they've Sundays turned up, and if Alan Saint-Maximin turns up, they blow teams to pieces. Granted, probably their best result was against Bournemouth, but then who did they beat 3-0 in like the first match? What?
Sheffield United, but they got
Sheffield United, yeah, because that was another sort of absolute bizarre one. So they've suddenly clicked into gear as soon as the season starts and basically pulled themselves free of being involved in any relegation dogfight. Also, Brighton, I mean, having both Liverpool and Arsenal having played them, you know, they played a fair few, and also United, they played a fair few of the big teams, but they, you know, they played pretty well throughout the whole time. They are always a constant threat and they do always give teams a go. They might not win, but they're doing what Norwich, I think, intended to do in terms of go down fighting, but they're doing it to a better extent than Norwich, who are just sort of, well. Yeah, I think in general, those are teams which have particularly impressed me, but yeah, Spurs at the moment. I mean, that Bournemouth game, I had it on in the background. I didn't really watch most of it. I could just hear the commentary and it was I'm glad I didn't watch it, because it sounded like 90 minutes of people's lives wasted.
Callum, let's talk about Tottenham now then. Is it as simple as putting it down to, as a lot of people are, that Mourinho has lost his touch, or are there wider, more systemic problems with Spurs?
I mean, it's that horrible cliched bit of a bit of both. Mourinho seems, it's way straight, the game might have evolved past a bit, and then it's also, he's done some particularly unproductive things himself, like picking a fight with Tongi and Ndombele and forgetting that Ryan Sessegnon exists, seemingly. Being more willing to play a random youth guy than him at left back makes no sense to me, having seen Ryan Sessegnon over the last couple of seasons. But it's just, it's also, this is when it's coming home to roost for them with the not making transfers for 3 years or whatever, not making basically any transfers for 2 or 3 years. So this is where you're getting that squad that's kind of been a bit hollowed out, where everyone's aging a bit, where Harry Kane's ankle is made out of crab meat, that kind of thing. Because to a large degree, that's the biggest issue with them, is Harry Kane just not being what it used to be. Because you could see, at least in theory, this functioning like an old-school Mourinho-Chelsea team with Harry Kane as Didier Drogba, but Harry Kane can't start and finish moves in the way he could before. So he's increasingly dropping deep, but then that means there's no one on the end of anything. So it's partly just a dysfunctional team. And then it's also Mourinho. It would be, as you saw under Pochettino, they'd be having problems anyway because of the age profile and stuff like that. But Mourinho's making it worse, is what I say.
Yeah, that's the impression that I've gotten. Benji, do you want to come in on that?
Because, yeah, you know I did.
Yeah.
But it's got to the point where Spurs are stale. A lot of the team players now are the same as 15, 16, as Callum points out too. The lack of recruitment finally catching up to them. And it just looks disjointed. I mean, the positives of their season has been Giovanni Lo Celso at times, and he will be a good signing. But you're sort of getting Mourinho Pogba vibes with Mourinho and Ndombele, which is not good for, I mean, Spurs' record signing, I think. And he's come into the Premier League with outstanding potential, and Mourinho's putting him on the bench and then bringing him on when things are going badly. Honestly, like, if Spurs fall out of the Europa League, we know they're not going to get Champions League now, then it could spell trouble. I mean, they've taken a loan out, but like, they've got stadium debt to repay, and the club don't make big signings as it is. So who knows what can happen? Yeah.
Because I was listening when it was the game on Monday night against Everton. I'm sure Martin Tyler said something along the lines of Tottenham are at risk for the first time in a decade, I think it is, to not be playing European football, whether that be Europa League football or, you know, Champions League football in more recent years. And like you kind of said, Benji, with this new stadium to play for and, you know, the lack of transfer activity in recent years, it's kind of, it's going to be a major blow, Jez, isn't it, for Spurs if they don't qualify for European football this year. And you know, it's going to make Mourinho's job even harder to try and make them a competitive force that only 12, 18 months ago they were.
He's the worst man to have in the club at this moment. He is by far and away the worst, because the problem is, if things are going badly, Mourinho just thinks about number one. He just thinks about himself. He won't, you know, if Tottenham finish, I don't know, ninth, say, don't get European football, and if Daniel Levy then says, right, well, we've got to sell a bunch of players, Mourinho will spend the whole of next season just whining, saying, well, what do you expect? I had to sell some of my best players. You know, he'll completely deflect all blame or responsibility. He's on, I think he's the joint second highest paid manager in the league now, along with Klopp, which is ridiculously stupid. I mean, the Amazon documentary is going to be fantastic to watch. It's just going to be sort of dustbin fires going on left, right and centre with that club. But in particular, they have a midfield that, in theory, with Lo Celso and with Ndombele, who has the potential, in my opinion, to be arguably one of the best midfielders in the world. You know, he showed it at Lyon, and you know, he's being linked constantly. He's being linked quite a bit now with a move to Man City, and if that happens, we're all doomed, because if Pep gets...
Or Barcelona. They're trying to swap him to Barcelona now. So.
Barcelona,
yeah, but I'm fine with them going to Barcelona.
That could fix Barcelona.
Yeah, but well, Callum, we know it could in theory, but this is Barcelona. Do you actually expect them to use him well?
They'll probably sign Matic.
Yeah, probably. But, you know, they've got him and Lo Celso, who they should be building the team around as a future point for their midfield, and they won't. They'll just, you know, they'll probably sell Ndombele at this rate because they, you know, they'll think, oh, well, lots of people seem to rate him and think that we could get at least the 50 million back for him. Because, you know, if you said to Pep, do you want Ndombele for 50 million? He probably would bite your hand off in a heartbeat. And it's, I think this, it's going to be one of those cases where Tottenham are going to look back at it and probably think, probably hiring Mourinho might have been one of the worst decisions we made in at least a decade. It will be sort of the, it could even be the Roy Hodgson Liverpool-esque sort of moment in terms of, sorry Callum, I know you love Roy, in terms of just sabotaging a club for a decade and leaving so much of them to clear, especially given the fact that, you know, they got rid of Poch. Although just quickly on that, you know, I went back and looked at, you know, some podcasts, not that we did, but you know, some podcasts and videos by sort of various channels at the time when it was getting towards when Poch got sacked. And there was, you know, everyone said that, oh, you know, why did you sack Poch? There was a bit of a call for him. It's just there wasn't as visceral as I think there probably will be in 12 months' time for Mourinho.
One thing I'd like to add, yeah, I while Mourinho might have lost it, I don't want to judge him right now because I want him to, well, we have to wait until he gets his stamp of the club, his signings coming in. There's a lot of dead wood, stale players in that squad. If Mourinho is allowed to invest, I don't know how much he will be. I don't know what will happen. Maybe they'll sell Ndombele and sign some of Mourinho's players like Nemanja Matic and like Fellaini, but who knows. But like, I feel Mourinho needs to be given a full season in charge. Obviously, it's most likely that he's lost it, but I don't want to say it myself just in case he hasn't.
Yeah, I think because of how good his reputation is and his back catalogue of management is, there's always that underlying fear of, oh, what if he recaptures that? But he, you know, his time at Man United and his time at Tottenham kind of illustrate so far, and kind of the end of his period at Chelsea, second time around, kind of suggests that he might not be the manager that we once knew. In regards to one of his former clubs, though, who've kind of, you know, hit this latest period of games by storm, Man United, like you said, they're one of the teams who scored three or more goals in the three fixtures they've played, albeit they were against Brighton, Villa and Bournemouth. Callum, is it, you know, in the same way I was saying, is it as simple to blame Mourinho for Tottenham's faults? Is it as simple as saying Bruno Fernandes is the difference for Man United being as good as they have been in recent weeks?
Bruno Fernandes almost feels like the secondary part to me, because the primary thing, because they're better than even before the restart when Bruno Fernandes came in, it's that they're actually playing Paul Pogba. Plain and simple, they're actually playing Paul Pogba. Because he's the guy who in midfield can pass the ball forward. He can pass the ball. He can, and the good thing, Bruno Fernandes makes Paul Pogba better because Pogba is at his best when he can start and finish moves, as opposed to having to start, make and finish a move. Or make and finish, or, you know, any sort of other iteration of those three things. Bruno Fernandes being there in the middle means that Pogba can get the ball, progress it out, pass it to Bruno, get past him, or get on the edge of the box, or anything like that, and then make stuff happen. You see, because even after the restart, the real change has come since Ole started playing them together, which seemed blindingly obvious to everyone who was watching who was not named Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, but it still takes something to do. And the other thing we have to remember here is that Mason Greenwood is not going to finish like this forever. It is more extreme than when Marcus Rashford burst on the scene. He's got, I forget how many goals Greenwood's up to at this point, but it's from something like 2.5 or 3 expected goals.
I think he's on 8 goals.
Yeah, so whilst players who are 2-3 who do this and the other might be able to be a little bit better than that, as we saw with Leicester's season just cratering on itself once Jamie Vardy stopped finishing at 40%, it's going to come back to earth. And that's the other thing I have to remember, is that United aren't quite as good as they look, at least by the scoreline. They've looked very well, but that's partly because when you're not playing the golden retriever Scott McTominay and you're actually playing Paul Pogba, you're going to look a lot better. That's really the key thing. Like Bruno Fernandes, he's a Hollywood player. Like, he'll go for the Hollywood ball, he'll go for the Hollywood, he'll shoot from outside the box a million times a game. He's doing some good stuff, but it's the whole size ball functional because Pogba's actually being able to do his thing.
Have you been impressed since Pogba's return, Benji?
Yeah, I mean, a year ago, a lot of United fans and maybe me as a neutral were calling for his head. Maybe it was best for both parties if he had left and United reinvested in the money in someone who cared. But it honestly seems like that, like, Pogba's fitting really well into that squad. Like his long balls are terrific. I've always enjoyed watching Pogba, and I've always thought he, until United turned good again, that he could make it at a better team like Real Madrid or something. Maybe that would have been best for him. But now I think his plan is definitely to stay, and I think he could honestly be part of a United team that could challenge for the Premier League in a couple of seasons.
And just Callum mentioned him there, another player who's been, you know, extremely impressive for United since the restart. Well, throughout the whole of the season, to be fair, is the youngster Mason Greenwood. I think it's rare in the Premier League that when a youngster bursts onto the scene, they combine that raw pace and energy with real efficiency in front of goal. Just how exciting and a prospect is Greenwood?
Very. If you're especially for an England fan, it's very exciting. I think he is level with Wayne Rooney for the number of goals he scores in a season at this sort of age. I think he's the same age as Rooney was when he broke through. The main thing though is how two-footed he is. He doesn't seem to have I know his left is his preferred foot, but he's just as comfortable on his right, which is something that's fantastic. And the fact they've been able to play him on that right-hand side, which has been seen for, I don't know how long, as a problem area for United, having a right midfielder so much that they were linked with Sancho. Now they've said they're probably not going to go in for Sancho. If they're playing Greenwood there, that's great. My worry with United, though, is that their squad is paper thin, really, in terms of there's a reason that Ollie is having to play this same. You can pretty much expect the exact same Man United 11 week in, week out, apart from maybe Matic swaps for McTominay if they need to rest Matic's legs. That's the only change I can see them doing. It's because especially their forward line is so thin in terms of the depth they had there. It's great for Greenwood because he's getting all this match time really early and he's getting this experience. But you're also saying you are depending on a 17-year-old to, like Callum said, continue at a rate of scoring that is ridiculously above any expectation. The same thing with the expected goals ranks with Bruno. I think Bruno's outperforming his expected goals by nearly double, especially with his long shots from outside the box. I just quickly on Fernandes. I'm almost expecting him to part the Red Sea, by the way, that the commentators are sort of throwing so much praise and saying that, you know, what he can do. It is getting a little bit too stupid, I think, in terms of the hype he's getting. He's been very, very good, but he's probably had, in my opinion, the similar impact that Van Dijk had coming to Liverpool's defence. He's had that coming into United's attack, in that he's been that final cog that's got everything properly working now and flowing very well. I'm not saying he's on a par with Van Dijk or anything, but in terms of, you know, the impact of one player coming in to sort of get a lot of things clicking better, he's had that. But also, just, you know, quickly, United have had a very easy run. You know, that's something which I think a lot of people forget. They haven't had any tough games. Their toughest game of this entire run, I mean, yes, they were very good in the Manchester Derby before lockdown, but their toughest game since restart will... I wouldn't say Tottenham's a tough game anymore. their toughest game that they'll have in the restart is their last match, which is against Leicester, which could very well be a game that determines who finishes in the top four, I expect, by then.
The two things I wanted to say about Man United as well is, whilst I'm not going to take away from their achievements as they come back, because they have been good to watch and, you know, they have been exciting and there is promise there. Number one is that I still have massive reservations about that defence and that back four, because if you look at that Bournemouth game, the first goal that Stanislas scores, how Maguire lets him get past there and you know, allows him to finish is ridiculous. And then you go back to Bergwijn's goal for Tottenham and how easily they kind of cut through. So I think that there are still you know, limitations to that back four. Another thing I wanted to say, you were talking about the hyperbole that's surrounding Bruno Fernandes in the media jersey. I don't know whether you boys picked this up as well, but during the Aston Villa game on Thursday night, when was it Thursday night? I can't remember. And the penalty decision, which, you know, I'll be honest, I think it's a scandalous decision that it was given. When Fernandes basically stamps on, I think it's Konsa, he stamps on and then falls down in the box. But then when they cut to Gary Neville and Roy Keane to explain what they thought about the penalty, they both said, oh, it's Fernandes being clever. It's like, it's just cheating.
Well, that's the thing with
being clever is a real thing because of the whole situation where you don't get a penalty unless you go down. So you see things which should not send someone to the floor, sending them to the floor, because even if it's a legitimate foul, you're not getting a penalty unless you go to the floor. That was just, I wouldn't even say that's Bruno Fernandes being clever. That's just a weird situation where he sort of gets disrupted doing that spin with Konsa coming in. It's just a weird situation. He didn't really have any. I don't know what you give that as. I honestly don't know, because you could argue it's a foul both ways. So yeah. I don't know what you give. But it's not Bruno Fernandes being clever.
No.
That's also, Paul Pogba against Spurs is someone being clever to win a penalty.
Yeah. But also, sorry, you know, you cut to the studio and you have two boyhood United fans who were, you know, probably legends for Man United. What are you expecting them to say other than the pro United line? It's the same when you do the post-match interview. You know, they ask the same question. If you saw it on Match Today, they asked the same question about the penalty to Dean Smith and to Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Shock horror, the Man United manager said, yes, it's a penalty. The Aston Villa manager says, no, it's a penalty. What do you expect?
Yeah, well, you, Callum.
Callum,
you're spot on there in the sense that you can be clever. Like, there are so many examples of players running through to the box and they kind of arc their runs in anticipation of getting contact and winning a penalty. And you're like, okay, that's clever because you're anticipating where the hit's going to be. That was just pure Fernandes. I don't know what was going in his head when he thought that was an acceptable and positive thing to do, but it worked out for him anyway. That kind of leads me on to another point I wanted to get your lads' opinions on. Throughout the course of this period, VAR has again been at the height of the conversation. You look at the controversy in that Man United penalty incident, Southampton's penalty at Goodison the other night. It's the match officials, committee, whatever it is, have come out and said that shouldn't have been given as a penalty. There were various other kind of incidents across the course of the week. Benji, I wanted to ask you this one. VAR was kind of meant to be introduced as a bit of a safety blanket, if you know what I mean, in that if a referee made an incorrect decision, that would be there to turn it around and make the right decision. Is VAR simply a safety blanket for referees so that regardless of whether they make a bad decision or not, they're always going to be supported so that they don't face scrutiny or the headlines?
Yeah, there has been. I mean, I think it's got better. Not excusing the Thursday night where they all admitted all the three decisions were wrong in three matches, but like it has got better in the ways that they can the VAR can contradict the referee and tell the referee, okay, you're wrong. But because at the start of the season, they weren't really telling referees they were wrong. They were just saying the referee was right, and then they had to adapt that. Personally, for example, sorry for using Arsenal, but the Leicester game, I mean, they told the referee to look at the screen, which I'm all in favour of, because I feel that like the referee should at least be able to look at it. If they can encourage the referee to look at the screen in football matches like they do in the Bundesliga, it's not very hard compared. And the Premier League have just made an awful, have done an awful job with VAR this season. When they review it at the end of the season, they need to come up with amendments to these laws that have seen like ridiculous goals being disallowed, like the Lucas Moura Harry Kane one against Sheffield United. Yeah, there's a lot of room for improvement in terms of there being a safety net. I guess there has been a degree of protection with referees, but I don't know. I think that's improved throughout the course of the season for some reason. I honestly, yeah, it's confusing for me.
Callum, is it I'm trying to think of the way to describe it, because another thing that's kind of came into question over the last few weeks are just simply rulings of football. So the idea of this clear and obvious rule not being clear and obvious, and the way that that's subjective and can be interpreted. So do you think that there's a deeper issue than just the technology, that some kind of rulings and classifications of the game need a bit more clarity?
Well, that's what I've said for the past 2 years, really, whenever anyone's complaining about VAR, is that your problem's not with VAR, your problem's with the rulebook. Because in 99% of cases, the problem is basically because of the nonsense that we've had from commentators for years about stuff like intent that's not actually part of the rules, is that people don't actually know the rules. And whilst there are some rules that, because IFAB just seem to love making new stuff, it seems like they love having stuff to announce. Every year, there's always some kind of tweak to something that they have to announce. And so it's partly that, but it's also VAR lays bare a rule book that isn't great, whereas a lot of these things are written to be used in a non-VAR world. So it's like there's a little bit more subjectivity and stuff like this in there. So it then means that when you're trying to put it in a VAR world, it doesn't necessarily work as well as you might have liked. And then it also seems like the Premier League doesn't want VAR to succeed. They waited a year, then they've sort of done it, implemented it in such a way that it was always going to cause problems. So part of it is because the Premier League won't want to succeed. But the biggest thing is, yeah, anyone's problem with VAR, 99% of the time, is actually a problem with the rulebook. And so it's problem is the Premier League can't go away and fix the rulebook. That's IFAB, and they aren't going to fix it, it doesn't seem. But you can do a little bit of guidance stuff. Like one of the things that I've said, we should probably have, is to sort of judge handballs like Spain, where it's just, it's a handball if it hits your hand. Because it's where it's particularly when you bring VAR in it, how do you know it's a handball? How do you know if there's intent most of the time? And then some of these other instances, it's just unfortunate. Like, no one would think anything of Lucas Moura one if the being called a handball, if it hadn't squirted to Kane, who then scored. If that happens further back on the pitch or anywhere else on the pitch, then it doesn't. It's one of those anywhere else on the pitch ones, which is normally why penalties should be called more than they are, but this is one where it's, if it hadn't led directly to a goal, people wouldn't care. People are like, oh yeah, what? It feels a bit annoying and hard done by, but it's a habit.
Jez, what's your take on all things VAR?
I mainly agree with Ben in the sense that I think there should be much more encouragement for the refs to, you know, just go and have a look at the monitor. Just, you know, almost sense of, are you sure? Just check that. Almost like they do away in the Champions League. I mean, I can only think of one game, and it was made such a big deal of it when the referee has gone over to check the monitor at the sign. I think that was Michael Oliver in a game between Crystal Palace and someone. And it was a non-matter game. I think it was just a mid-table clash, maybe like Palace-Burnley. And he went over and checked, and there was something sort of, oh, well, you know, we've been saying all season that referees should do this, and he's gone and done it. Oh, you know, such uproar at it. And it was a case of, yeah, but that's just, he's done the right thing. But the VAR said, I don't think, you know, basically saying that, you know, I'm not sure your initial decision is correct. Do you want to just double check that? They get to go over, they get to have a look at it back and go, you know, no, I'm going to stick with my original decision. I think that was right. Or that was an obvious error by me. Okay, we're going to do that. That's the way I think it works. I think Cam's exactly right in the sense of the rule book issue is a bit of an underpinning issue, and it probably is why VAR gets so much of the sticks. People just blame that rather than thinking, well, is it that or is it actually the rule that has caused them to have to make this decision? As a first year of it, I don't think a week's gone by without someone complaining about one thing to do with VAR. Now, whether that's because it's something new and people think that it's something you can easily claim and have a go at, maybe, but I think there's probably going to be some changes made to it, you know, at Stockley Park over the 2 week break in between the seasons when they, you know, work out what they're going to, if they're going to change it at all or what they might change it to. But it's a forward step And it's the first step in probably getting it, hopefully, to a usable state. But I think the big surprise, the big frustration for a lot of Premier League fans is, why is it in the Bundesliga and in the Champions League it seems to work so much more efficiently than in the Premier League? Is that because English referees have a higher opinion of themselves than in those competitions? Yes. Is that because English fans are more quick to blame referees for decision than in any other league? Yes. Is that, you know, there are, I think, more cultural problems regarding how we approach a referee and also how referees view themselves that has probably contributed to this, and that actually VAR has probably exposed.
Callum, as someone, as a follower of European football as well, would you just go on to latching on to Jez's point there about the fact that VAR has worked better overseas than it has worked here? What is your kind of reading of that? What's the cause of that, do you think?
I mean, it's one of these things where it's not perfect. That's the thing we have to remember, is it's like, even in the Bundesliga, there's been issues. There are many questions you can have about some of the refereeing decisions to do with Real after the restart in Spain. There are many questions you can have there. But it's always your most... But also, it's in part because your referee conspiracies are on a different level than they are here. So it's different in terms of it with that, where it's always here. It's like, oh, this ref hates us. But it's of a different tone. It's not sort of fed in the same way. It's always where it's like, oh, Barcelona fans think this one guy hates them, whatever. But it's because the process feels more transparent in a lot of ways. So it's partly just that no one else has done the thing which has led to most of the issues, which has led to most of the whining. I'll just call it whining here, where it's drawing the lines on the offsides. No one else sees the process of that happening, which is the biggest thing that's really been latched onto as a problem with the AR. It's just, in the Bundesliga, they give you the final lines. You don't see them being drawn, which seems to be what sets off a lot of people. And it's, yeah, part of it is that we just are bad because of the culture with having, you know, 5 minutes when you take out the ads on the halftime break to blame the refs for so many of these things. Blame a ref, blame a guy for missing a shot that he should have scored, and you're done with your analysis. And it's a lot of it is still in the same realm of complaining about referees. The thing is, with so many of these, if we took out the VAR, we still have a load of moaning about the original decision. Because either we'll get these same angles that people then decry when it's VAR used to justify where the decision should have been given differently. Or it's just people are just unhappy because everyone thinks that all decisions that aren't clear-cut for the other team should go for their team. So it's just everyone around Europe, weirdly, given how much more passionate they are in a lot of ways, just gets a bit more calm about this. Because it's what it's... And because it seems like there might be a higher standard of proof in these other leagues. Like, that's the biggest problem with some of these... Talk about Real and how some of their refereeing decisions have been extremely questionable, is that watching La Liga, it seems like there's a higher sort of trigger point for actually doing a VAR process. So that makes a difference as well. If it's what it's... like, that's one way you can't really legislate it, so that it's, oh yeah, clear and obvious is this as opposed to this. It's one where it makes it work better if it's used more sparingly.
Yeah, it certainly feels like, as you and Jez have kind of alluded to, it does feel like VAR is kind of the product of some cultural problems as well with how football is consumed in this country, as much as it is to do with classifications and the technology itself. The final thing I wanted to talk about, lads, today is in regards to how the bottom of the table is looking. Now, has this last period of games, Benji, that we've had, has it concluded which two teams are going to go down? So do you think two out of the three spots of the relegation zone are now secure?
I personally think, yeah, obviously Norwich are gone. I think the fact that Bournemouth didn't win against Spurs was detrimental because they're going to be playing Manchester City away. I think Bournemouth are, although they're 18th, right, they're almost certainly down. Villa's run-in is just going to be too difficult, and it just seems that Moyes is able to get the best out of a couple of West Ham players towards the end of the season, so they do enough to stay up. That West Ham-Villa game at the end of the season that we talked about on a previous show about the clincher, I see that going towards West Ham, because Villa have got unlucky with that against United, but they were never going to win that game. They've looked awful, and their run in is so tough that I don't know how they'll be picking up points. So I've got to say, maybe if not, I think three of them are sort of. I mean, Watford could still go down, and there's other teams, but I still think it's now going to be Norwich, Villa, and Bournemouth.
Jez, Benji kind of alluded to it there. Bournemouth not beating Tottenham. They thought they had done with that last-minute goal, which was disallowed. Just looking at the fixtures this weekend, West Ham go to Norwich in a game that you would kind of West Ham kind of need to win, and you would expect them to win. Watford take on Newcastle at Vicarage Road, and Watford, you know, winning the other night at home will certainly give them confidence. And then Bournemouth, you know, have got the tricky task of Leicester coming to the Vitality. Was that game the other night crucial, you know, for Bournemouth? If they would have won that, do you think their chances of survival would have been significantly increased? Do you think, like Benji said, that they might have given themselves a bit too much work to do?
Yeah, I think Bournemouth have gone, in my view. I did think that since that game. I do agree with Ben. But, you know, I say that if you said to Bournemouth, you start the restart, and you're looking at, you know, Spurs at home. Yes, I know we've lambasted Spurs quite a bit, but you still expect Spurs to go away and get something, at least a draw there. So it's not, I think that result, whilst the performance probably merited a win, you know, Tottenham could say that they were denied a penalty in the first 5 minutes. So it's one which very easily could have gone both ways. I think Bournemouth might look at it more as just, you know, it's 1 point gained. But realistically, they are. They're the team that, hilariously, I know I've probably this week talked about fantasy football more than I have in any other podcast we've done, but it's the team that hilariously every single sort of people when they're talking about it are saying, well, you don't want to take that player out because they've got Bournemouth in a few weeks' time. They are shambolic defensively at the moment. You know, stories flying around that Solskjaer wants Ake because he said, oh, we might need a left-sided centre-back in summer. I'm sorry, Harry Maguire is a left-sided centre-back. I don't understand that, you know. And also, why would you want Ake? He's, you know, he's fine maybe for depth, but he's not outstanding. I don't know if any of you guys caught it's not no filter, like BT Sports is one where it's like the pitch side thing, and you can hear the comments. That Ramsdale's sort of explosion, I think, is probably explosion of explicit language at his defenders after United got their fifth, I think sort of summarises their whole defensive unit. It's not cohesive, it's sort of very fragmented. They've also, I didn't quite see who it was, one of Bournemouth's defenders, was it Adam Smith that got injured? One of their defenders. Yeah, and he was actually probably in that game when I was watching it, one of the few defenders that was really digging in, really trying to put in all the work for them. You know, he then goes off. They bring in Jack Stacey, who's, I think, a 17, 18-year-old they got from Luton. You never know, might be brilliant. But, you know, I just thought, you know, Smith is a guy that for the last few seasons has often been seen as a bit of a leader for them in that back line, is someone that has that grit of a defender you'd expect maybe more from a Burnley than a Bournemouth. And now he's gone, and it's just sort of, you know, anyone can probably walk through, even Everton can probably walk through this Bournemouth, could probably walk through this Bournemouth.
Calm yourself, Jez. Calm yourself, mate. Callum, I mean, you, over the 3 years I've had the privilege of getting to know you, you've been one to enjoy having a pop at Eddie Howe and Bournemouth. However, in the 2 years prior, I mean, they've kind of got away with it, and they've kind of been involved in a relegation scrap this intense. Why this season of all season has it gone so badly for them? Has it just all caught up with Eddie Howe?
I mean, the big thing is, you look at every other season, they've played like this for most of the season. It's just those other seasons, they've got off to a good start and they've completely gone off a cliff and sort of, they've been sort of kept afloat by that good start. Whereas this season, they didn't have it. It's why it's sort of been a case of all season, like Bournemouth might go down this year, it's because they didn't have that hot start, because Callum Wilson wasn't quite, whether it's him, whether it's the team, whether it's luck, whatever, he didn't have that return. Early in the season, they have been poor defensively the whole time. And it's ways where it's partly just, they've always been like this at this point of the season. It's like last season, there was, people forget about it because it's like with Norwich this season and like with Southampton this season. People just think about the last time they actually saw a team. So everyone last season was like, oh, Bournemouth pretty decent. Because, but after that Chelsea game, which is the last one everyone remembers from last season, they didn't win another game. They've always been really riding this line. It's just once where they were finishing 15th, they were dropping down into 15th as opposed to dropping from 15th into the relegation zone. And this is one where, yeah, they've finally been caught out by not having that good start. And then you've had stuff like Ryan Fraser having some issues getting motivated, I guess you say, where he's talked about that. And then now he's gone. He's a free agent right now. And it's just, when you don't have that hot start, when you don't have Callum Wilson doing enough for you, when you don't have Josh King doing enough, when you don't have... when you have,
which was injured.
And when you have some, when you have those years of questionable transfer dealings, like giving Liverpool free money over and over again, it's just going to catch up to you. That's the big thing with Bournemouth, is it's catching up to them. They are doing things like signing Philip Billing, is one where it seems like he might be not very good because it's for, or it's like not a Premier League quality player, but then when he's then getting played together with Jefferson Lerma, they have no passing and stuff like that. So it's partly Eddie Howe not being a good manager on that front as well, where it's just, it's got worse and worse for them. And it's just, this is going to take them over the edge when they should arguably be 14th relegated this season. They are going to be one, they're not going to be the one that misses out like they would in other years.
Yeah, it certainly feels like it has been coming, and like you kind of said, it's caught up with them, that poor start they've had. The other team that are kind of in that bottom three and are, you know, set to go, because, you know, when we were doing our, you know, quiz earlier, we were saying Villa are a team that haven't scored throughout this period of games. Jez, are they, like Norwich, just a Championship team who have punched above their weight for the most part of the season, but have been found out in this last month or so?
Yeah, I think so. It's odd with Villa, because of those bottom teams, when you look at it, you know, like I said, Norwich dead and buried, Bournemouth are pants. When I watch Villa, they have actually impressed me. They have actually been good. It's just that they seem to just lack that final end product, which you half expect to partly come from Jack Grealish. But if you just mark out Grealish from the game, it does seem they can't do anything. I agree with Callum in the sense of there are probably, really, when you look at it, four teams in this season that should go down, but obviously three do. And I really don't know, because if you're Aston Villa and you play and you're looking at it, I'm just going to quickly get up there running if you just bear with me. I mean, they've got, you know, Crystal Palace coming up as this game, which is, it's, you know, it's winnable for them potentially, but I'm not over sure, because the problem they've had all season has been that everyone has lambasted them for saying they overspent, they spent way too much money, they did, you know, all the stuff on that, the comparisons with Fulham. But like I said last time, you know, with both Fulham and Villa, they had an awful lot of loan players, which they then had to, you know, either buy in replacements or, you know, buy those guys in, which probably inflates a bit of the value a little bit. It also, you know, their attack has been pretty appalling, has to be said. I can't see them now escaping. I think I still stand by. I think Watford will just have enough. I think West Ham have found a bit of form and will probably stay up. So I think they might be the team that comes in 17th. I think they will probably finish above Bournemouth. I think they deserve to finish above Bournemouth, if I'm very honest. But it's a case of, they are bad, but are they as bad really as Watford? I don't know. Sorry, I've just got the run in. They've got tomorrow they've got Crystal Palace, then Everton next week at Goodison, so that'll probably be a 0-0 draw. Then they've got Arsenal at home. That could go any which way. And then they've got that big game. Sorry?
Not anymore.
No, that's true, actually. I do think that Arsenal will probably win that. And then they've got, you know, West Ham last game of the season, which we were billing as a potential relegation six-pointer, when actually now it's probably just going to look like a well, I don't know really, but it's not an easy run for them whatsoever. And from that, you're thinking, maybe 3 points at the most they can pick up from that run.
And it's not going to be enough to keep them up that at all. Okay, so the last question I wanted to ask you guys, I'm going to save it for Benji, actually. A little bit of a mini preview for a game that's taking place this weekend. It's the small matter of a North London derby between Tottenham and Arsenal. Benji, of course it's going to feel different because, you know, there's no supporters in the stadium, so, you know, the atmosphere that's usually associated with this fixture won't be there. But from a purely footballing point of view, you must be quite confident that Arsenal can go there and you know, take Tottenham to the cleaners.
Whenever Arsenal have come in as the favourites in the North London derby, it never goes our way. I'm honestly, you know what I'm expecting? I'm expecting a draw because that always happens. But I've got to say this, if Arsenal cannot beat Tottenham on Sunday, this might sound harsh on us, but we don't deserve to finish above them and we are the banter team. Because honestly, they have been poor, and we have had, I'd say probably a week ago, Wolves away was a more daunting prospect than Tottenham away. And Arsenal came to Wolves, we won. We got unlucky against Leicester and should have put them away in the first half. And about the fans, yes, it'll probably mean my heart isn't beating as fast as it usually does, but I'll still feel nervous because I honestly feel this is Arsenal's best chance in years to get that one over Tottenham and then start the rebuild. I do think that hopefully Arsenal will be vindicated that we didn't get Mourinho and we got Arteta. I hope that will go well for us. I'll be positive and I'll predict 2-1 victory.
Optimistic,
but it'll probably be a draw. I'm just warning.
But it'd be interesting to see if we do get a Mourinho masterclass in that one, or Arsenal will continue their good form.
He knows how to set up a team against us. That's the thing.
Yeah, I think that's the one fear. But I think Arsenal should be confident going into it. So yes, a big kind of bunch of games that we've kind of gone through there. There's another round of Premier League fixtures that have to take place this weekend. Big games, including Norwich versus West Ham, Brighton against Manchester City, and the North London Derby, like we said, on Sunday. So we'll be back next week to talk through those matches. So a big thank you to Benji, Jez and Callum for joining me for this one. Hope you enjoyed the quiz, boys. Get watching the games this weekend and cluing yourself up for next week's one. And yeah, we look forward to seeing you then. Take care.